Thank you. I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to talk here. And so the organizers have asked that I give an overview, thank you, over diluted magnetic semiconductors. And I'm happy to do that. I will start by giving a few reasons why these materials are interesting, not only for possible applications, but also from the fundamental physics point of view. Then I will discuss various materials classes of diluted magnetic semiconductors, or DMS. And after that, I will focus on one of these classes, which is 3-5 semiconductors doped with manganese, and show a number of key experimental results, and then list a few aspects which I think are important for any realistic theory for these materials, and then comment on some of the aspects of the modeling in more detail. And in the end, I will try to draw the connection with the topic of this conference. Now, why are people interested in diluted magnetic semiconductors? If you read basically any paper about them, or most of them, most of them start with saying that there are possible applications in spintronics. And but I won't focus on this application aspect here, but more on the fundamental physics aspect. And I think from fundamental physics, there are two large classes of two broad reasons for why these are interesting. For the first, I've called here control of magnetism. In the diluted magnetic semiconductors, like in any semiconductor, one can control the carrier concentration by doping and also by application of a gate voltage. But in the DMS, the magnetic interaction is mediated by the carriers. So by changing the carrier concentration, one also changes the magnetic interaction. And this is a type of tunability one does not have in ferromagnetic metals, where you cannot change the interaction between the magnetic moments. So this gives a whole new type of control over the magnetic properties and opens the possibility of new types of experiments. And one can also hope that by the right growth techniques, one can also have control over the positions of the local moments, not only over the interactions. So one has a system where one has much more control over the magnetic properties than in other materials. The other reason why these are interested is that the semiconductors form what I here have called a physics construction set. What I mean by this is that in semiconductors, one of course observes all kinds of interesting effects, for example, those effects down here related to reduced dimensions, Coulomb blockade, and the quantum Hall effects, and recently also superconductivity. And to this list, the magnetic semiconductors add the aspect of magnetic order. So in principle, in one material class, one can tune between regimes with very interesting different ordering phenomena and can explore what happens if one crosses over from one regime to the other, and whether new effects appear due to the competition of these effects. And only very few of the possible combinations here have actually been explored. So now, what types of materials we are talking about? Ferromagnetism, and I will concentrate on ferromagnetism and not on antiferromagnetism here. Ferromagnetism in semiconductors was discovered in the 60s, and I think the first material was chromium bromide, and shortly after, europium sulfide and europium oxide. These are non-diluted magnetic semiconductors, because every cation has a magnetic moment. And the magnetic interaction here is not mediated by carriers, which is simply seen by the fact that the Curie temperature, there is a ferromagnetic order even in the undoped compound. So these materials have been studied in the 60s and 70s, but now there's renewed interest in them, fueled by the diluted magnetic semiconductors. And people are, for example, looking at this compound here, gadolinium-doped europium sulfide, which is interesting because the gadolinium is an n-type dopant, so it introduces carriers, but it does, to a first approximation, not dilute the spin system, because gadolinium has virtually the same moment as europium. So here one changes the carrier concentration, but not the spin concentration. This is the opposite as compared to what one usually does in diluted magnetic semiconductors. In the diluted compounds, there are several classes depending on the type of host material. First of all, there are the 2,6 materials, which have been studied also for several decades. And in them, manganese, which is the usual magnetic dopant, is isovalent. So there are very few carriers because of this. And that's the reason why here, and yeah, why here for a long time, no ferromagnetic order was observed at all, because magnetic interactions here turn out to be mostly carrier mediated. So to have strong magnetic interaction, one has to introduce carriers, and this proved to be difficult. And only recently, people have achieved ferromagnetic ordering at low temperatures by modulation doping. Then there are the 3,5 compounds, like gallium arsenide doped with manganese. These have been studied by far the most intensively in the last few years, especially the first compound here. And in gallium manganese arsenide, Curie temperatures around 160 Kelvin are now observed. And all these materials, manganese is a p-type dopant because it's 2+ replacing a 3+ cation. There are now and then new claims of higher Curie temperatures, for example, recently in indium manganese arsenide, and for a few years ago in gallium nitride. I think one has to be careful with these claims, because it's not always clear whether the system is really a homogeneous diluted magnetic semiconductor. Especially in the nitride case, there are strong indications that the magnetism is not really there where the semiconductor is. There are ferromagnetic precipitates probably in a non-magnetic semiconductor matrix, which is not what we mean by diluted magnetic semiconductors. Not all is clear here, obviously. Also, what's also important, and I will come back to this, is that even though manganese is a p-type dopant, the hole concentration is usually lower than the concentration of manganese due to the presence of a large density of compensating defects. Next in line, there are group 4 semiconductors. Of these, germanium has been made ferromagnetic by doping with a few percent of manganese. And this system behaves somewhat similarly to the 3,5s. And the Curie temperature is also of the same order. And finally, there are oxides, like zinc oxide doped with cobalt. Here, the situation is less clear. There are claims of room temperature ferromagnetism, and also claims that there is no room temperature ferromagnetism in this system. So yeah, there's still controversy here. But I think also the oxides, in principle, could offer the opportunity to have high Curie temperatures. But the physics here is not that well studied. So now I will concentrate on the 3,5s, in particular on the system gallium indium arsenide doped with manganese. Thank you. This here is a plot, on the left is a plot from a very important paper by Matsukura et al., which was the first one to show Curie temperatures in excess of 100 Kelvin in gallium manganese arsenide. What this also shows is a metal insulator transition as a function of manganese concentration. For small manganese concentration, the samples turned out to be insulating at low temperatures, and for higher manganese concentration, they are metallic. This sample here was not very homogeneous, so one should not take this to put too much weight on this here. In newer experiments, higher Curie temperatures are achieved due to improved growth techniques, which basically involve reduction of the concentration of the compensating defects, mostly arsenic atoms at gallium size, so-called arsenic antisites. So in that case, 160 Kelvin can be achieved. And also then, always the Curie temperature increases with manganese concentration. And in these new experiments, it doesn't turn down again, it just saturates at around 6-7% manganese. And yeah, in these new experiments, the samples are always metallic due to lower manganese concentration, and there's no metal insulator transition. I will come back to how one can understand these observations. Another very general, very generic experimental observation is the change of the shape of the magnetization curve with annealing. I want to concentrate on the low temperature part here of these curves. There are similar curves by other groups. For the S-grown samples, the magnetization decreases linearly starting at the lowest temperatures and then has a strange upward curvature. With annealing, with annealing, this crosses over to a more mean field-like behavior with downward curvature. Another observation which is important is that the Curie temperature proves to be the highest for thin films, and it is not as high if one caps the thin film by some non-magnetic semiconductor. Both these observations are interpreted in terms of defects diffusing to the surface of the sample during annealing, compensating defects diffusing to the surface, which is of course simpler for thin films, and it's prohibited, it just doesn't work for if there's no free surface. This plot on the left here shows just the original data for which shows the metal insulator transition for low carrier for low manganese concentration. The resistivity just goes up as one approaches the zero temperature, typical Anderson insulator behavior, whereas for higher concentration it goes down slightly and saturates at low temperatures, more and more metallic behavior. Also seen in this plot and also in this here is another quite robust feature, which is a maximum in the resistivity at the Curie temperature. This feature is also not, I think, totally understood now. Then there's an important negative result. There's no colossal magnetoresistance in these compounds, which indicates that the magnetic interaction is not double exchange. And pointing in the same direction are new cyclotron resonance experiments, which show that there are many effective mass type holes. So the holes, at least at higher manganese concentrations, do not reside in a very narrow impurity or D-like band, but more probably in the valence band. So then it turns out that defects are important. And so what kinds of defects are there in these materials? First of all, there are substitutional manganese impurities, of course. And it's known from the low doping limit that isolated manganese substitutionals are in a D5 configuration plus a weakly bound hole. So they form a shallow acceptor. This is, I should stress, quite different from the nitrites and gallium nitride doped with manganese. The manganese is a deep acceptor, deep in the gap, and that it's deep in the gap comes from a strong Coulomb interaction with the manganese acceptor, and the Coulomb interaction is strong because the hole is strongly localized due to the state has a huge, has a large content in manganese d orbitals. So for that reason, it's strongly localized. It has larger Coulomb energy. For that reason, the theory usually applied to the 3.5 DMS does not usually work for the nitrides. Then it's also known from the shallow doping, from the weak doping limit, that there's antiferromagnetic in exchange direction between the hole spin and the manganese local moment. But it's not quite clear what happens if one goes when one goes from weak doping to the high doping limit, because previous experiments I quoted suggest or show that there are effective mass type holes, but this seems to contradict this these photo emission data here, which clearly show flat band close to the Fermi energy. This is interpreted by the experimentalists as a impurity state, but this doesn't quite work because if one calculates the width of the impurity band for this concentration of 3.5% manganese, it would be so broad that it merges with the valence band, so it's not clear where this flat feature comes from. And there's no theory at present, but I know that, for example, Al McDonald suggested that this is a manganese-induced surface state, which somehow leads to this here. But that, as I said, there's no theory, that's just an idea. Secondly, there are the compensating defects. It's known that the low-temperature growth technique needed for these materials also creates arsenic antisites. These are double donors, so they need to compensation and reduce the number of density of holes, but they can be suppressed by suitable growth techniques. The other type of compensating defects is manganese interstitials, and in very elegant X-ray Rutherford backscattering experiments, it has been shown that there are these interstitials are in fact present. About 17% of manganese in this particular study was found in interstitial positions. And in new X-ray absorption experiments, which are not yet published, it has been shown that interstitials really move to the surface during annealing, which is what was suggested based on these thin film studies I mentioned on the previous transparency. So finally, for the experimental overview, I would like to show these experiments which demonstrate the control of magnetic interactions by a gate voltage, indium manganese arsenide. This is the original work. Here, the Hall resistivity is plotted as a function of temperature, and the Hall resistivity in zero field is a measure for the magnetization. At zero gate voltage, one finds this solid curve and some value for the Curie temperature. Then as gate voltage is applied of one polarity, the Curie temperature is decreased by about a Kelvin. For the opposite polarity, it is increased by about a Kelvin, and the whole process is reversible. So one can really move the Curie temperature by application of a gate voltage, or if one works at a fixed temperature, one can switch between the paramagnetic and the ferromagnetic phase by the gate voltage. And this is used in this experiment, which demonstrates reversal of the magnetization only by changing the voltage in a constant applied field. What is done, so in this inset here, the hysteresis loops are shown for two different gate voltages, and what is done is the system is magnetized at a higher gate voltage corresponding to the red curve, and then the magnetic field is inverted, but the sample is still remanently magnetized in the opposite direction at this point here. Then the gate voltage is switched off. Suddenly the remanent magnetization is no longer stable. The system jumps to this point here on the black curve, and or in this big curve from here to there, and at this point here the voltage is switched back on. But now the system, of course, stays in the magnetization stays in the field direction. So the switching has been done only by changing the voltage here in constant field. So now let me list a number of aspects for which are, I think, important for theory. First of all, I would like to stress that potential scattering is very important in these compounds. And yes, and just as an illustration, I show here a result of Monte Carlo simulations of the defect configurations that we did in this letter here. And here, this plot shows typical result of such a Monte Carlo simulation. The blue, small blue spheres here are manganese substitutionals, and the small green ones are manganese interstitials, and the large red ones are arsenic antisites. And what one sees is that the defects form small clusters, in particular defects of opposite charge prefer to sit at neighboring sites, of course, and this leads to a partial screening of the potential, of the disorder potential due to these impurities, and it reduces the disorder potential by quite a lot, and I'll come back to the consequences of this. I should also say that I've written in this review paper here, where there's of course much more material that I can cover in this talk here about specifically about the defects of disorder in DMS.
This is some kind of classical Monte Carlo.
Yes.
Mimicking the growth process. Or it's,
Yes, so but this is also, the model is quite simple. It just takes into account the electrostatic interaction between charged defects.
But it's Monte Carlo for equilibrium in the bulk, or you actually model the growth?
No, it's equilibrium in the bulk. And just want to find the equilibrium configuration of the defects. So one can either say that one assumes that the defects are mobile, that there's defect diffusion, then this is the state which eventually results from a kneeling. Or one can argue that a similar state should appear during growth, because also oppositely charged defects like to be incorporated close to each other already during growth. But we didn't simulate the growth specifically.
But this assumes very fast mobility of the manganese. So in reality, I think it's an upper limit on the cluster formation.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that. So then secondly, there's also another source of disorder, which is exchange scattering of the holes, the spin scattering of holes from the local moments. But I want to emphasize that this is weaker than the potential scattering, which is important because there are theoretical papers studying the disorder effects which keep this into account but neglect that. And this, I think, is not consistent. Then thirdly, there's spin orbit coupling. I will come back to the effects of spin orbit coupling in a few minutes. And one thing the theory has to address is what happens to the impurity states as one goes from low to high doping, which is not yet totally clear, or at least there's no total agreement on this. And another point which is important is that the carrier concentration is, as I said, typically smaller than the magnetic impurity concentration, which means that these systems are not in the Condon regime. The Condon regime would be the opposite, many carriers and few magnetic moments. Now, if one wants to model diluted magnetic semiconductors, one can start, and people do start, from two conceptually opposite approaches. First of all, one can start from low doping. Then the physical picture is one of isolated impurity states, and transport happens through hopping of electrons between these impurity states. This naturally leads to a percolation picture, both for the transport and also for the magnetic interaction, which is, after all, mediated by the carriers. One can estimate for which local moment concentration, this or impurity concentration, this works, and just by estimating the width of the impurity band and seeing when this merges with the valence band. And as I say that, I would say that this is applicable, should be applicable for manganese concentrations below about 1%. Then it is relatively clear that there can be ferromagnetic order, I think, from these works in this model. The question is this type of ferromagnetic order and this percolation limit realized in the diluted magnetic semiconductors? And I don't know whether this is the case. The second approach comes from the high doping limit. If one includes, in the high doping limit, it's more reasonable not to talk about isolated impurity states, but about electrons or holes in bands, in a beauty band or in a valence band, if one adds to this hole and beauty exchange interaction JPD, what one gets is basically the so-called Zener model, which has been applied to the 3.5s by Dietl et al. And if one uses a very simple model for the bands and mean field approximation and so on, one gets simple analytical expressions for the Curie temperature, which are in fact even in the same, give the correct order of magnitude. There's not much more that one can learn from that here. This model here neglects potential scattering, which I've claimed is important, and it also treats the RKKY-like magnetic, infective magnetic interaction to impurities only at the mean field level. So one, these are things one should take into account beyond the simple Zener model. So now I would like to comment on a few points in a little more detail. First of all, description of the band of the bands in this high doping limit. There are basically three levels of complication here. One can either use an effective mass approach for the bands. This gives qualitatively reasonable results, but quantitatively doesn't agree so well with the experiments. So to have a more realistic description, people use either a Cohen-Luttinger K dot B Hamiltonian, which gives the band structure expanded to order K squared around the gamma point. So it's okay if the physics is dominated by this area around the gamma point. Or one can use a tight binding Hamiltonian like this, and if one just fits these parameters here to reproduce the experimentally known band structure, one basically gets what's called Slater-Costa tight binding theory, and this can be made realistic for all k values. Secondly, I already said the Zener model consists of some model for the electronic bands, plus this local exchange direction between hole spins and local moment spins. If one solves this in the mean field, this interaction here in the mean field approximation, and in the so-called virtual crystal approximation, meaning that one averages over the local moments in space, then one gets gets these results here shown in this plot for the Curie temperature of various semiconductors doped with, each doped with 5% of manganese. And this is an iconic plot shown in nearly every overview talk about DMS. It's from a science paper by Thomas Dietl. And for example, if you look at gallium arsenide, it predicts a Curie temperature between 100 and 200 Kelvin, which is not bad, in fact. And it also predicts that indium arsenide with manganese should have a significantly lower Curie temperature, which is why the higher Curie temperature reported for indium arsenide is so surprising, because it's against the trends of this calculation here. And the trends, I should say, seen here are mostly due to the change in the lattice constant. Okay. Perhaps show this. Now, I've said that potential scattering is important. Potential scattering leads to localization and thus also to a metal insulator transition. And as an example, I show here calculations for. So what we did here is we solved a single particle Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian for the electrons in the disorder potential due to the defects. For the defects, we assumed that they have formed these clusters. So we first did the Monte Carlo simulation to get these clusters, and then solved the single particle Hamiltonian for the holes. The concentration of defects and the concentration of holes were taken from experiments. So doing this on the left-hand side for the original experiments from the Ono group, you find that for higher manganese concentrations, 3 and 5%, the Fermi energy is, I should say what's plotted here. This is the participation ratio as a function of energy. Participation ratio is a measure of how localized or how extended the states are. One should really do a finite size scaling to check whether they are really extended or localized, and we did that. But I only show the participation ratio for a single system size here. And one sees that for high manganese concentration, the Fermi energy is within the extended state, meaning that the system should be metallic, whereas for below 1% manganese concentration, it is in the localized tail, so the system should be insulating. And there should be a metal insulator transition at a few percent manganese, and that's in good agreement with what is actually observed. On the other hand, if one plugs in the numbers from the newer experiments by the Nottingham group, one sees that the Fermi energy always stays in the extended plateau here. So all the system should be metallic, and that's indeed what is observed. And I should add that we really need this cluster formation to get this result. If we just take the fully random configuration of defects and calculate the disorder potential then and calculate this participation ratio for this system, we would always find an insulating behavior. So it only gets metallic due to the reduction of the disorder potential by this clustering. The next point, or next points I want to make are related. Yes?
You haven't shown the small enough manganese concentration from the Edmonds group to get the same, get the localized state.
Because they haven't done experiments at lower manganese concentrations. So these are the actual concentrations they had in the experiments.
So you're not making any qualitative assessment of the sample quality there. I mean, you're just saying that's another experiment. Samples are metallic in experiment, and in theory, they're in localized states of also metallic.
And I'm just saying that this theory qualitatively agrees with that there's a metal insulator transition observed in these samples and not in these samples. I'm not saying anything
more. Right, but I'm just saying that the metal insulator transition occurs in the Ono samples at a manganese concentration not studied in the Edmonds.
Yes, but you see that the Fermi energy here changes, doesn't change at all in these Nottingham samples. So I wouldn't expect that it suddenly moves to the localized states if they had measured at 1% manganese concentration. So the next topic is quantum critical points. I've here drawn a tentative phase diagram of DMS. X is the local impurity spin concentration, T is temperature. There are two quantum critical points here. One is the paramagnet-fermagnet transition, and the other is the metal-insulator transition, and they are experimentally not at the same concentration. So one question which is immediately springs to mind from this is what are there any effects due to the interplay between these two close-by quantum critical points? I've drawn in here these generic crossover lines, and something should happen where these cross here. And this, as far as I know, has not been studied, but it's certainly interesting. Another thing which has been studied is it has been suggested by Galitsky and Dasarma that in this paramagnetic region here, there are Griffith singularities, which, as you know, are related to the existence of rare ordered regions in these disordered systems, so regions which can be locally ordered even though the whole system is macroscopically paramagnetic. That's another interesting aspect. And another aspect is that there's really not another transition here on this line, which is the concentration where the impurity band merges with the valence band. And it's not at the moment clear at which manganese concentration this happens, and whether this happens to the left or in between these two points or to the right. So this is a more technical question, important for finding the right model. Mm. The next slide here is about effects of spin orbit coupling in DMS. So far, two effects of spin orbit coupling in DMS have been studied. The first is the anomalous Hall effect. There's a Hall electric field proportional to the cross product of the applied electric field and the magnetization, local moment magnetization. Because of the time, I cannot go through this in much detail. There are basically three proposed mechanisms for the anomalous Hall effect. Two are known as skew scattering and side jump scattering. Both are related to disorder. And the third one is an intrinsic effect not related to disorder and has to do with Barry phases accumulated by the argument is a semi-classical one. So wave packets moving around accumulate Barry phase, and this one can show in a rather non-trivial way lead to an appearance of the anomalous Hall effect. In the ferromagnetic phase, of course, the average magnetization here is finite, so there's a finite Hall voltage then, and based on this Barry phase mechanism, this was studied by Jungfeld et al. In this letter. On the paramagnetic side, the average magnetization is zero, of course, but this correlation function of the Hall voltage is in general not zero. It's related to the correlation function of the spin. And this means that the noise in the Hall voltage is related to the spin, dynamic spin susceptibility. This we have proposed here. And there's now an experimental group in Regensburg at the university which is trying to see this experimentally. Another effect which we have found more or less by accident during this work here is that there's anisotropic spin diffusion. Just briefly, if one creates a spin excitation locally, say by circularly polarized light, then this decays, of course, it relaxes, but it also diffuses. And it diffuses more rapidly in the direction of the magnetization component. By this I mean the Z component of the whole Hall magnetization diffuses more rapidly in the Z direction than in the X and Y directions. So if one creates a circular excitation region, it would become cigar-shaped if the excitation is only in the Z of the Z component of the magnetization. And all, of course, all these spin orbit related effects only work for p-type ferromagnetic semiconductors, because only for the valence bands there's a large effect of spin orbit coupling. For the conduction band, the effect is very small. I come to magnetic interactions. So there are several contributions to the effect of magnetic interaction between the local moments. The first one is an RKKY type interaction, which can be written in this form, just some tensor of exchange constants depending on the separation, vector times the two spins. Now, this interaction is anisotropic. First of all, it's anisotropic in real space because the local exchange interaction between the holes and the local moments is also anisotropic. And the reason is that it comes from an interaction between electrons in arsenic p orbitals and in manganese d orbitals, which just don't sit at the same site. For that reason, it has to be in k-space k-dependent and also anisotropic. And this anisotropy combined with the large anisotropy of the band structure leads to a large anisotropy of the RKKY interaction in real space. Here, this plot shows this RKKY interaction as a function of separation scaled by R squared to make it better visible for large separations. The various colors are for different crystallographic directions and also for different components of this tensor here. And what I mean by this anisotropy in real space is that at a given separation, say, look here around 40 angstrom, there is the strength of this interaction on the sign depends on which direction in space you are looking at. And secondly, this interaction is also anisotropic in spin space because of spin orbit coupling. And this means that this tensor here really does not reduce to a scalar times a unit matrix. For example, the black and the red symbols refer to the XX and YY components of this tensor in the 1 or 0 direction, and one easily sees that they can be quite different for the same separation vector. So secondly, there's second contribution to the magnetic interaction is nearest neighbor super exchange, which is antiferromagnetic. And then, and it's also important, and thirdly, there's multi-spin interactions which have not been studied in much detail, but they have been estimated to be comparably small. These interactions here, the RKKY and also the super exchange, lead to frustration, and frustration in turn leads to non-collinear magnetization. But it turns out that this effect is smaller than one originally thought. So the reduction of the ground state magnetization by this frustration for random distribution of defects is only of the order of a few percent. This is we've also found in this paper here, and Greg Feet and others found basically the same thing starting from a different model in this preprint. Okay, I'll skip this, I think. Now let me summarize those points which are related to the topic of this conference. I've divided this into various categories. First of all, fundamental aspects. One thing I mentioned is that there's this interplay between the metal insulator transition and the paramagnet ferromagnet transition, which is interesting. And secondly, there are the Griffiths-McCoy singularities. On a more general level, there's the question of the interplay between the disorder and the magnetism, in particular quantum magnetism in the system, for which this Griffiths-McCoy work is just an example. And finally, there's also the question of interplay between spin-orbit effects and local moments. From a practical and experimental point of view, I've said that it's interesting that one can tune the carrier concentration and thereby tune the magnetic interaction in these materials, which allows new kinds of experiments. And thirdly, there are device aspects which I didn't talk about at all in this talk. For example, one can use the DMS as the polarizer for the spins, the carrier spins, and then study effects like spin injection across a barrier between different semiconductors and so on, and also current-induced magnetization reversal. But because of the time, I didn't discuss this here. But there's one experiment I would like to show here, because I hope that someone can shed some light on this somewhat puzzling results. This is an observation of a quantum integer quantum Hall effect in a 2.6 DMS. Now, what happens here is that in a moderate magnetic field, the local moments of the manganese here are totally fully aligned. So that leads to a relatively large, very large exchange splitting of the Landau levels, much larger than the Zeeman splitting and also larger than the cyclotron frequency. And one can work out what to expect then for the integer quantum Hall levels in this situation, because this exchange splitting is basically field independent, whereas the Landau level splitting cyclotron frequency is, of course, be dependent. That's relatively clear then if one thinks about it, what happens. But what is really puzzling is this observation here. This is one sample with a relatively low carrier concentration and low mobility. The red curve is the Hall resistivity, and one sees that it rises more or less linearly until it reaches the quantum resistance value and then stays there for fields between around 3 and 27 Tesla. And this is consistent with being a quantum Hall plateau filling for filling factor 1. If one looks here at the longitudinal resistivity, it has a maximum at this step here and then goes to 0 and stays is very small until it seems to recover here at the highest fields. But I find it very hard to explain this very long quantum Hall plateau here if one assumes that, as one usually does, that each Landau band has one extended state in the middle. So then I don't understand how one can have a Hall plateau over a range of magnetic fields spanning a factor of 10. But perhaps someone can comment on this. This is only published in these conference proceedings here, but I talked to the main author and they are writing this up to publish it in some journal. So yes, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
We have time for questions.
Yeah, I have one question about these experiments of Okabayashi et al. And the impurity band. You said there was some problem with interpreting that as an impurity band. It was either too broad or too narrow. Or
yes,
I was wondering
I
if
said,
you could comment
yes.
on that a bit more.
It was this experiment here. Let me show this again. Yeah, the question is, what is this narrow band? Experimentalists say that, this is obviously an impurity state, so an impurity band. But if you just calculate the width of the impurity band, you know how large the impurity states are for low doping. You know the Bohr radius of these hydrogenic impurity states from experiment and also from calculation. That's no problem. So you can calculate the overlap integral of these impurity states. And from that one, you can easily calculate the width of the impurity band. And if you do this for 3.5% of manganese, you find that the impurity band is so broad that it strongly overlaps with the valence band. So then it's hard to understand what this is. Also, I should say, it's too narrow. So that's clear from the experiment. But what's not in the experiment, they didn't measure or quantitatively the spectral weight of this feature here. So it's not clear whether this is bulk or surface, or it's only a small effect or a large effect, really.
Thanks. I have a comment and an advertisement, I guess. First, the comment. Is that for the optical conductivity, it seems quite clear that there's an impurity band. I don't see any other way of interpreting the data for the optical conductivity.
Oh, yeah.
Right, at 2,000 wave numbers, there's a peak, and it's impurity related.
Yeah, but I mean, we have in preprint by first author is Hankiewicz and on Kontmart will probably be published in PhysRefB, where we calculate this optical conductivity from a valence band model, and it agrees quite well with the data, in fact.
How can it agree with the data? What is the 2,000 wave number?
So what's in there is, one, we put one, phenomenologically put a narrow band in the gap associated with the antisites, not associated with the manganese. So this makes the fit better, makes the experiments fit better.
So it's still an impurity band, it's just not related to the manganese.
But it has nothing to do with the transport properties. It's an empty band.
Okay, then the advertisement.
That's sort of not really an explanation. That's just putting it by hand. That's like, well, I'm going to put in something by hand, which is 2,000 centimeters. So then the question is, why should that band be there? I mean, other than getting agreement with experiment in this particular paper, it's not no other purpose.
Well, it's known that the antisites lead to states below the, of course, obviously they don't. So they have their impurity states below the valence band, below the conduction band.
I'm objecting to it, but I'm saying this is not an explanation unless that band is showing up somewhere else also.
Yeah,
this is just a topology.
That's right. But what I'm saying is that it's natural that there is a feature there because the antisites do lead to impurity states below the conduction band. And since there are less antisites, then much less antisites than there are manganese, it may be that the impurity band related to the manganese has totally fused with the valence band, and there's still an impurity band related to the antisites.
And just an advertisement that there's some new data on iron silicide doped with cobalt that I have in back, which goes a long way towards answering the questions raised about the Hall effect, the anomalous Hall effect, and also points out that a system like that avoids many of the problems that you have in a system like a 3-5 mm-hmm. manganese dope 3-5 or 2-6. So I invite you, if you have an interest in this, to come talk.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
I have a question. Yeah. This quantum Hall plateau that you showed, that's one thing that you talked about that I didn't know about at all. Can you just go back to that plot? Now, what is the problem here? The plateau could, I mean, I don't see any problem. It's a wide plateau, so what? I mean, what is happening? Let me propose a scenario. It's a tautology, okay. What I'll propose, but this tautology will explain this. You have huge broadening, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every Landau band is broadened 1 electron volt. I mean, it's not 1 electron volt, but it's, you know, tens of 10. I mean, this is exactly what I expect. I expect each plateau to be extremely flat, extremely broad, and eventually they'll see number two. But what magnetic field is a matter of details. What the next extended state is, where that is, you know, one has to calculate. It's indeed true that if they keep on going and they never see the second Landau level, there is a problem.
No,
but they haven't seen it.
No. The second Landau level is here. No?
So
this is nu equals one. So there's nothing more. It would only be fractional news.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. My prediction is somewhere here. So they are going straight from one to the insula. That's the. It's beacon is very, very dirty. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's so dirty that you just don't
yeah.
see
that.
Yeah. No. What I'm saying is that it's kind of strange, but it's not. It doesn't violate any principle. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so the problem I have with this is the following. So if you assume that you have an extended state in the middle of all the Landau bands, and okay, let them be very broad. So then the steps between the Landau levels should occur at 0.5 and at 1.5. So that's a factor of 3 in the filling factor and corresponding to a factor of 3 in the magnetic field. And not to a factor of 10 in the magnetic field. So that would mean that for some reason these Landau bands are extremely asymmetric.
They're very asymmetric, right? Because we already know from simple scattering calculations, self-consistent bond approximation just beyond that the details of the band structure, this Landau band structure, depend rather strongly on what kind of scatterers you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you made the case, which I agree with, scattering here is very important and very complicated. Now, this is not, again, an explanation. I mean, one should do the calculation, but it's possible that you have extremely asymmetric Landau band structure because of this very strange scattering. Do you remember the mobility for this? I should be able to figure that out.
It's
by
50
50,
meter.
That's high mobility for this system. 50?
It's high.
50?
Okay. The experimenters say it's called this moderately low, I think.
Usually it's around 5 or something like that, 5 to 10.
No, it's 50 okay. In this case.
So, you know, it's a very dirty system. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's uninteresting, but it's probably not impossible.
No, I'm not saying it's impossible. So, yeah, if the band can be very asymmetric, I agree, then one could understand this.
And if I may ask another question, can you summarize the status of the understanding of anomalous Hall effect? Because there's so many theoretical papers and so many experimental papers on it, I do not know. I mean, do people now believe that the scattering, skew scattering, side scattering, all these things do not matter at all? It's all a generic.
No, there's no agreement on that. But I can only say most of the papers now favor this Berry phase effect.
No,
but there's no good reason for that.
No, that's because theorists like that sort of thing.
Yes,
that doesn't mean that's happening. I mean,
that's right.
We need to distinguish between what is reality and what we like. And
yeah,
often
no.
Reality is not what we like.
That's right. I think that's, it's not settled, I would say.
Perhaps. perhaps in answer to that last question, some experimental data might help. If you plot the Hall conductivity of a vast number of metals, magnetic semiconductors, heavy fermions, well, the heavy fermions act differently, but a vast number of ferromagnetic metals, they clearly lie along a line on an sigma XY versus M plot, and that would argue that it's an intrinsic effect, and that's why the theory, basically it's a Luttinger theory that was looked back on by Youngworth, Nui, and McDonald, and that seems to work quite well. So if you, in fact, I have the plot in back, and you should come and see it if you have an interest in what that, what the data, the experimental data look like.
I think Naoto Nagaosa may have something to say about anomalous Hall effect later on Thursday, is it? Okay. Great, so we should move on. Let's thank Carson one more time.